to the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, you're just getting back from Israel. And here's something that I just do not understand, and maybe you can help me. You know, Joe Biden said he's open to using force against Iran to prevent them from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Now, I think one of the reasons why we are so opposed to Iran having access to nuclear weapons is for fear that they would somehow use them on Israel. But I don't understand, Sandy, why the President of the United States would say he would be open to using force to prevent Iran from gaining access to a nuclear weapon. What kind of crazy talk is that in the world to say those things publicly, that you use force against Iran with all the other nations that have nuclear weapons? Can you pick out one nation and say you can't have it and we're willing to have to use force against you? Does that make any sense to you?
Well, you know, we've talked that same way about North Korea, but we haven't actually been willing to use force. It might be that talking like that is the same as talking about sanctioning China with respect to its transactions with Russia on silicon chips and the like. I do think that in the United States, at least politically, it's almost a political third rail not to talk in the same manner that he's talking now about being willing to use force against Iran, because the feelings about Israel and its safety run so deep in American politics that it's kind of a mandatory position to take. He did, in the same breath, or in the next breath, talk about how he thought diplomacy was the answer, and his administration has talked openly about being very intent on reopening discussions to with Iran to get the settlement that Trump walked away from, the agreement, the Iran nuclear agreement reinstated. So, you know, I kind of think he's talking out of both sides of his mouth there, and my hope is that he's more interested in the diplomatic solution than he is in the force solution.
But clearly they put $100 million that they gave to the Palestinians to deal with hospitals and other things. You just don't get why a president of the United States has to speak like that. There's no reason, no rhyme or reason to talk like that globally and use that kind of verbiage. I just don't know what's to be gained by that.
I think it has more to do with domestic U.S. politics than it does with world politics, quite frankly. And in campaigns within the United States, it's been almost mandatory that politicians talk like that. And so they do.
Yeah. There's no way you're ever going to be able, when you're talking like that, and maybe they're not looking to ever build any kind of relationships with Iran. There's apparently nothing redeeming to our nation with that nation. There's nothing that can, similar to what happens with Cuba. These will always be nations that we'll always vilify. And there's no good that can be derived from a relationship with us and those nations.
I'm not sure. I think that the next generation of State Department folks might take the same view that was taken for a while during the Obama administration, which was that opening up relations with Cuba, for instance, could have a very moderating effect on the political regime within Cuba, as it actually did in China for quite a long time, and as it might have in Russia. And I think there was a view as well that Iran, once it was brought into the world of world commerce and was no longer blockaded from it, would moderate its views on many things, including most probably its views about Israel. So I think that there is another school of thought, but right now the dogma that's required in American politics is this very hawkish approach to dealing with Iran.
You know, Sandy, and then that gets us back to what we were talking about earlier in the week about our Congress again looking to expand, you know, the finances militarily to the Pentagon, and it's this kind of saber rattling that makes people, it's almost like it goes hand in hand, right? I mean, you got to keep the American people alert. We got, you know, there's this threat from Iran, so we can't ever say we need to cut the budget, the military budget, because after all, Iran's trying to get a nuclear weapon, and the American people just buy into all of that.
Well, I mean, you know, the more threats we've got going, the more fronts that we talk about, the more likely it is that the Pentagon requires a massive amount of money. We've got China, we've got Russia, we've got Iran,
North Korea,
threats on all these different fronts, and instead of them mellowing out and becoming less threatening over the last years, apparently our view is that they've all become more threatening. And so if they're more threatening, then what's required is a tougher stance, and half of the way we demonstrate our tougher stance is to spend more money on defense. I talked about this inflationary spiral, but there's also kind of a defense expenditure spiral that relates to our foreign relations and the rate at which we, instead of moving in the direction of detente and peace, move in the direction of tension and saber rattling.
You know, Sandy, historically there have been presidents in our nation who knew that probably at the root of some of these things is, you know, our policies have frightened other nations based on our power. And maybe other nations do what they do based on the fact that they're afraid of what we are going to do. And if you look historically at some of the things that we've done, you would think that those other nations would say, you know, we can't trust that the United States won't do these things that we've seen that they've done historically. So we better prepare ourselves and defend ourselves, but that's never the way it's portrayed in our country. And how right. dare any of us say anything different, right? I mean, if we have the conversation, it's like we're traitors because we're really just telling people exactly what is happening.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the facts in terms of who's been militarily active in the world, if you look at the facts associated with who's actually used nuclear weapons, if you look at the facts about, you know, the number of wars or police actions, as we've called them, that have been carried out by countries, the United States is way ahead of anyone else in terms of behaving like that. So people, our so-called enemies who talk about that, do have a bunch of facts to point at to demonstrate that our foreign policies frighten them. And so being frightened causes them to act in certain ways, too. And I think I've talked earlier about how, you know, historians will analyze this far better than I can. But there's certainly some level of bona fide fear that resided in Russia with respect to the expansion of NATO and the ways that it was carried out from 1994 until 2014. I think the American people, and you talked about certain presidents that have done a better job of evaluating the reality. Two of those people, quite frankly, are people who I don't otherwise necessarily hold in hugely high esteem, but Dwight Eisenhower was the one who first identified the military-industrial complex and the danger that it posed to the American economy and to American society, and he was dead on, as history would show. And then it was Nixon who opened up relations with China and took an action that had the biggest potential for changing the dynamics in the world towards a more peaceful situation. And of course the wall came down during the period of Reagan. I don't know what all the basis for it. I'm not sure that can the value of that and the credit for that can be given to Reagan. But the fact is that the Democratic Party has kind of traditionally required that it be very hawkish about foreign affairs, I guess, to offset the claim that liberals would be soft on our enemies.
You know, Sandy, I hadn't given it much thought, but I do remember when Richard Nixon was able to break down the walls with China. I remember that well. But I didn't remember that it was a Republican in Richard Nixon all this time until you just said it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Henry Kissinger, his Secretary of State, was quite a dynamic guy. He had his own view of real politic, was much more pragmatic and less ideological. So we have to remember that when he broke down the walls and the opened up relations with China, he was opening up relations with Mao Zedong, who was, you know, a very strident, ideological communist leader. And so, you know, that same thinking could have opened up the relations with Cuba, and it could have changed things. You know, I think that our opening relations with China had everything to do with China moving away from its Mao Zedong version of communism into something that is much more like Western norms.
And you know, Sandy, historically, people will say kudos to Richard Nixon for that, because look at where China is now. And that could have never happened had Richard Nixon not done what it was he did. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday with Sandy Williams. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday is with Sandy Williams. Sandy, you know, I'm going to be bold enough to broach this topic, but I'm sure we'll get some fallout from it. The abortion issue. And the fact that it is not going away, and the fact that this battle is going to continue to rage. But there's a side of it that you don't hear much about. And I just want to broach the subject. 844-967-2789 is the number. And that's the fact, Sandy, that, you know, contraceptives, right? Contraceptives are there so people don't have children, right? I mean, that's the whole purpose of contraceptives. Am I right in that assessment?
Oh, yeah. And you know, Planned Parenthood's original process was all about trying to help people understand the value of contraception in the process of planning families, so that children would be things that were wanted and expected rather than surprise additions to the world.
So why don't we spend a lot of time talking about preventing pregnancy as much as we do about aborting pregnancies? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's interesting, but you know, one of the restrictions on what can be taught in schools, or at least what the conservatives are trying to bring out as restrictions, to impose as restrictions on what can be taught in schools, is sex education. And it was always the intent of sex education, part of that would be focused intensively on contraception, so that, you know, one sector of the population that is most notorious for having unwanted children are young adults.
Yes. Yes. But
and so you know, is the conservative movement really intent on making it harder to provide sex education in schools that would provide the necessary knowledge about contraception to avoid the need for abortion? And you know, there were long restrictions on this. When I was in school, the you know, in Wisconsin, in high school, I graduated in the early 60s, there was something called the Indecent Articles Act. And the Indecent Articles Act made it impossible for schools to teach contraception.
Yeah, well, so they didn't teach contraception when I was in school. And but Sandy, is it... I mean, I don't understand why that part of the discussion, which would really kind of, you know, be an answer.
Yeah.
To am I off base with my thoughts?
Well, no, I don't think you're off base in your thoughts. And actually, Planned Parenthood still does have a substantial focus on contraception. It's gotten most of its notoriety out of its focus on abortion. But, you know, I was on the board of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin early in my legal career for a number of years. And at that point, Planned Parenthood was almost solely about contraception and teaching family planning. That's why it was called Planned Parenthood. And you know, what one thing that's worrisome now is this discussion in the news media about how it is that the Supreme Court and the conservative movement might want to take on contraception.
Yes.
And limiting contraception as the next step after limiting abortion. So, you know, wow. You know, it's one thing to talk about what happens with a child once conceived, but you would think that everyone would be united in their view. I realize the Catholic Church has been slow coming to this point, but you'd think people would be united in the view that the best way to have children is to make sure the children we have are wanted by their parents.
Well, there's no question about that, Sandy. And the fact that you don't have to become pregnant, right? I mean, if you don't want to. And well, I know this is a dangerous conversation, Sandy, but I just have thought about this, and I'm not against women having their right to choose.
Well, I mean, I suppose the conservative religious right would say, well, the way not to have children if you don't want them is to not have sex.
Right.
But the problem with that is that it doesn't take into account human nature. Okay. And it doesn't take into account the fact that in spite of that admonition and in spite of that fact, it occurs anyway, you know, and always has. You know, we can speak idealistically, but the fact is that the conservative right movement has a lot of idealistic views about sexual behavior, which it turns out the religious leaders don't follow themselves.
Well, well, I would agree with you totally. But, you know, again, Sandy, though, if and it's proven because the pregnancy rate for teens have gone down over, I would venture to say, over the last few decades. I don't know if that's because of abortions or if that's because they take contraceptives. You know, I know schools today, you can get prophylactics in some of the schools. And so there's been an open-minded kind of approach. I know it didn't happen, Sandy, without a fight, without a battle. But prevention, that certainly should be, you know, the order of the day before we talk about abortion.
Well, you would think. But the fear, I think, out there now is that whether or not that movement has, how successful that movement has been currently in terms of moving in the direction of more thoughtful conception of children, the worry now is that there'll be a backwards movement there in terms of both availability and education associated with contraception.
So this battle is never going to end. It doesn't matter what has been said, it's not going to end.
Well, I don't know. If the American politic is willing to look at such shiny objects and focus all their attention on this kind of stuff, it might never end.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. It's Fridays. Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, I want to talk a little bit now about the race between Ron Johnson and Democrats here on the U.S. Senate side of things. We've seen Ron Johnson now. We've seen more of Ron Johnson than anybody needs to see of him. Is he in trouble in your eyes?
Oh, gosh, he's certainly in trouble in my eyes. but is he in trouble in terms of the voters?
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I think he's pushed all of his chips onto the Trump pile. And I do think that there's a certain ebbing of Trump, support for Trump personally. I'm not sure that there's an ebbing in the support for Republicans generally, but I do think that that the Trumpists are slipping in terms of their control of the public. They still seem to have a lot of control over the Republican Party. But they might be, like many Republican pundits are saying, the Trump side of the party might be leading the Republican Party into a difficult and bad place. And I think that Wisconsin, while it has definitely is a bastion of Trump support in a hardcore group, I do think that there are swing votes that reside in the suburbs in particular who are not favoring Trump right now. And, you know, I think that Ron Johnson's strident support of Trump and some of the idiocy of the other things that he's done might cause him to have some trouble if he runs against a good, strong candidate. And I think the Democrats have at least a couple of those. I think both Lassery and Barnes represent very, very strong candidates.
So if I'm hearing you right, Sandy, doesn't matter that we keep seeing Donald Trump's face all over the place. His support is ebbing. Is it safe to say that inside the Republican Party?
Well, you know, like polling and support ebbs and flows. But I would say that right now there appears to be a sense both within the Republican Party leadership as well as generally out there in the public that while the Republican Party might have strength based on it basically not being the Democratic Party and the incumbent Democratic Party is going to be held at fault for certain circumstances in the country and in the world, I think that the Trump version of Republicanism has an ebbing level of support right now.
You know, Sandy, you watch a man like Donald Trump, and you would think that with everything that people have seen thus far and these damning commission, you know, things that we've seen repeatedly. And I know there are people who have now said, well, we still like MAGA, but we know that MAGA is bigger than Donald Trump, right? I mean, there are people who think that MAGA has outgrown Donald Trump. And so his beliefs, there are people who are going to vote for his beliefs, right? I mean...
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly Donald Trump had a couple of things going for him. He had his own form of charisma that evoked a spirit in, and I would say maybe a negative spirit that resided in a bunch of Americans. But he also represented a movement associated with this whole Make America Great Again thing. And I think that movement is alive. And I think Ron DeSantis and others intend to take a grip on that and ride the crest of at least those views without necessarily riding the crest of the Donald Trump persona. And I think Ron DeSantis is rising within the Republican Party as a significant potential alternative to Trump. I find him, from an ideological standpoint, at least as dangerous as Donald Trump in terms of the things he wants to accomplish. But a lot of what he's pursuing is just a continuation of the underlying ideological movement that Donald Trump represented.
So that movement is still strong enough locally and nationally that the Democrats don't have anything to fight that off, do they? I mean, there's no movement that the progressive movement is not going to be the answer to the MAGA movement, as you know, as we see it right now.
Well, I mean, there are different threats. I mean, there is the disconnection from politics as it was and as it is, okay? And there's this disconnection and disaffection with money in politics, and there's this disaffection with politics as it has been and is. That, I think, those are threads that the Progressive Party and the Progressive Movement has a great deal of potential to take a grip on. And I do think that you know, while the MAGA movement, Make America Great Again, was a theme that a lot of people viewed as being appealing, it had a lot to do with this thread of discontent with things as they were and a desire to return things to a better time or to get to a better place with better representation in government. And so I don't think MAGA necessarily is a theme that can survive for a long time through a thought process, because it's a retrospective theme, and I think pretty soon people are going to start turning to the future. And there's a whole generations of people in their 20s who didn't experience that America when it was great, kind of, you know, when if you think about retrospective views.
Well, you know, Sandy, it can survive for at least the 2024 election. It'll survive through that. However much longer it lasts after that, and that's the fear. Do you think it can survive through the 2024 election?
Well, I think some version of it will, but I think that the candidates who run against Ron Johnson will do their best to wrap their arms around proposing platforms and talking about policies that will be aimed at securing a strong economic position for the people they're speaking to, as well as for the U.S. economy. And so, you know, Make America Great Again, it had a magic when Donald Trump talked about it, because it had absolutely no specifics applied to it whatsoever. During the campaign of 2016, when he won election, he provided no specifics whatsoever about how he was going to make America great again. He simply ran on the proposition that America was crumbling and in a bad position. And, you know, and what happened during his tenure was a continuation of the business boom that had started under Obama, and he tried to take credit for it and did get credit for it in many respects, but he didn't get reelected for it. So, you know, I think there are those who say that even the strength of the MAGA process wasn't strong enough to overcome the problems that the Trump side of the party had created.
You know, you look at Ron Johnson and people like him, and they're just not capable of making any adjustments at all. They're all in on that message, and so there's no way for him to change his way, the way of thinking to his own. He doesn't have his own identity. I don't think he's alone. And I think, Sandy, that's going to be the death knell for him. He can't, as you stated, can't separate himself. He can't speak from the perspective of what he really believes and what he really feels. He can't honestly have a conversation with people because, as you know, you so stated, that's been his strength, and that's how he got to where he is.
Well, I mean, he did basically rode the coattails of an unspoken conservatism, saying we need to change things from the way they are. We need to run against government. He's been an anti-government candidate and an anti-government senator, and that might have been one thing that he could have stuck with, but he didn't just stick with that. He decided to jump on the Trump bandwagon and to become a zealot defender of Trump and to become identified directly with Donald Trump. So I think what he's going to have trouble doing is unsullying himself from the Trump image as the Trump image becomes as sullied as it is becoming and should become.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday. Friday's with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You text us that same number. You know, Sandy, man, you keep hitting the hammer, the hammer on the nail.
Hitting the nail on the hammer.
That can't be hitting the nail on the hammer.
No, hitting the nail on the head.
Hitting the nail on the head. You said early on in the Ukrainian war, you said that there's going to be all of this talk about war crimes and that you're not going to be able to believe all of it because one side is going to say something, another side is going to say something else. And as we kind of look at this thing as it's moved forward, this is in the New York Times this morning. Ukraine live updates: war crime inquiries face formidable challenges. Now, there's all of this conversation yesterday and today about the rockets hitting shopping mall, and you're watching the news and they're showing photos of a little girl pushing a stroller, and then they show the stroller after she's gone, the stroller's there, and they say, well, you know, they killed this little girl, and look at, they hit the center, and look at all these cars. And I remember you saying, well, it's going to be hard to believe.
Well, I the point is that war necessarily involves collateral damage. And as weaponry has gotten more accurate, maybe there's the potential for less collateral damage, but war has always involved collateral damage for civilians. You know, the carpet bombing that was done of Dresden, Germany, and was done across Germany and across Japan, the V2 rockets from Germany to England, the carpet bombing that was done by B-52s in Vietnam, the nature of the attacks that we used in Afghanistan, and the drones that attacks we did there, there's just been significant collateral damage always in warfare. And collateral damage is, in some respects, has the potential for being claimed as a war crime. The question is, what was the intent? The war crime requires that the intent of the action was to kill civilians and was not aimed at a military object. And of course, the Dresden firebombings and the Tokyo firebombings and a whole bunch of things that have been done in war in the past by us were not aimed at military targets, but they were aimed at taking the military capacity of a country away by removing public support for the war. And that has become also a strategy in warfare. And it's clearly probably a part of the Russian strategy as well. So I would just venture to say that the amount of collateral damage that's occurring in the Ukrainian war is a relatively small scale based on the overall scale of the war. And so have there been war crimes? There's a technical definition of war crimes that suggests that some have been committed, and however, that much of what is talked about is more in the nature of collateral damage. And the United States retreated to the defense of collateral damage in all of these other wars, defending conduct which was much more likely to cause the collateral damage probably than the stuff that's ongoing now.
Well, you know, if you're an American citizen and you see what we saw yesterday and the day before, and there's this pretty little girl pushing a stroller, her pink stroller, I don't know if you saw it, and then they show this explosion, and they show photos of or film of women standing in an office and the windows blowing in, and then people are going to think right away, well, what did they have to do with the war, right? Those are innocent people. But as you stated, you can't, you know, you're at war, man. It's kill or be killed. Isn't that what war is?
Well, the horror of war is the fact of collateral damage. And, you know, there have been, you know, there are videos of the drone strikes that Americans had in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know which country. I can't remember which country it was that struck a wedding ceremony with all these wedding guests, including children, right, and women, civilians, all of them. It just happens, you know, and there's the expression, you know, expletive happens, and it definitely happens in warfare, and it definitely provides fodder for this discussion of war crimes and brutality for both sides, you know. So I suspect that in Russia, there's evidence being provided and publicity being provided to the Russians of war crimes being committed by the Ukrainians. So, you know, I hate to be skeptical, because I think I have a belief that war is almost never warranted, and that while we might have pushed Putin into a corner, that he committed a horrible action and a horrible mistake with his invasion, but we shouldn't be astounded, and I'm not sure we have any justifiable claim for war crimes yet.
Well, you know, Sandy, it just gets to be more and more frustrating, and all the more reason that we need to find a way out of this as soon as we possibly can, right? The longer it goes, the more there's going to be that. I mean, you are going to do something, you're going to anger me, and I'm going to do whatever it is. I'm going to remember what it was you did. And so the more we see those things, the more difficult a process it is for us to even think about there being any chance to sit down and have a conversation that we can have about ending it, right? I mean,
yeah, and that's one of the problems with fanning the flames of this whole war crimes issue is that it does make it harder to negotiate when you successfully paint the opponent in a war as the devil. Then it's pretty hard to sit down at a table with the devil and come back and say you've reached a mutually satisfactory peace based on the conduct that you previously described as the conduct of the devil.
Hey, Sandy, I know you got to run. We'll reconnect again on Friday.
No, Monday.
Monday.
Yeah,
on Monday. All right, okay. Thank you very much, man.
See you.
Bye. I always appreciate, you know, Sandy Williams and... You know, his perspective on things so well thought out, so philosophical. But you know, the beauty of Sandy Williams is he can put it in simplest terms. You know, none of us want to see anybody harmed. Any person who has a conscience does not want to see people hurt or harmed. But he also sees it from the perspective of, you know, we've done some things ourselves. War is what you need to do, try to avoid at all costs. Because there's never, even when there's winners, there's no winners. Can you imagine what people have to live with knowing what they've done? We see it in our own nation where... poor guys who've been engaged and involved in war, you know, sleeping under bridges, eating out of garbage cans. Their lives are never the same. There's never any peace. They can't have any peace because of things they've had to do. Doesn't matter how many medals you pin on a person. What we're asking people to do is inhumane. And you can't say, well, it's because it's war and that's okay. No, that's not the case. We have to do everything within our power to avoid war. Men and women have not been created to destroy the lives of others. And the hardening of the heart that it takes in order to do those things is also not a normal or natural thing. So, you know, it hurts to see that footage. And I think that they do that so we can become more angry at the other side. But it's war. And nobody ever said that was going to be easy. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. You can join us. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be back.